Well, hello to and welcome to episode 9 of the Straz podcast. We are really excited about today's subject. I'm going to be joined by two of my colleagues here at Straz to talk about a very different subject for us, which is user-centered design and all of the work that goes into understanding the experiences that we put within technology. So, without further ado, I am very pleased to welcome Emily Anico and Gemma Waylett, who are both within our UI UX space within Straz. So Emily and Gemma, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks, Roy.
So I was really excited about this conversation because, you know, there are so many expectations out there that are set by groups like big tech providers, major technology firms of the world who have really shaped, I think, how consumers and users understand engaging with systems. So really, I'm just excited to hear what you guys have to say today. But before we get there, we'd love to just hear a bit about what brought you to our world of testing and assessment, particularly given your background. So Gemma, why don't you go first?
Sure. So my introduction into the world of testing and assessment was really by chance. I was encouraged to apply for a design role at Straz by a colleague that I had the pleasure of working with at my previous job. And I was told that Straz was looking for a designer to, you know, sort of help revamp and modernize the look and feel of Straz's products, which at the time was looking quite outdated. So my colleague, having worked with him previously, referred me as a potential candidate. I interviewed with Straz, and I've been here for more than 11 years at this point. I would like to point out, though, that currently I am contracted out to a project that is not within testing and assessment. I'm basically a user experience designer for a project that is aimed to assist auditors and the auditing work that they conduct within a centralized web-based application.
Well, absolutely. I think you've had quite the interesting track here, Gemma, in terms of projects, both kind of core within our space and outside. So we'll be curious to hear from that experience as we go forward. Emily, how about you?
So I actually interned with Straz while I was in college, and that was my first introduction to the testing and assessment world. I earned a degree in computer science and was all set to go into software engineering, but I was really drawn in by the UI UX side of technology, which is when I actually asked to intern with Gemma specifically at Straz and learn a bit more about that side of things. But I think my initial background in computer science has helped me a lot with my current role. Because Gemma and I are actually both responsible for design and styling implementation. UI designers don't always do that. A lot of times it's just design, then they'll hand off their designs to the developers, and then they'll do all the coding involved there. But I actually really love that part of my job. I didn't have to say goodbye to this part of my life that I spent so much time on, and I do really enjoy coding for the front end. The software engineering wasn't for me, but I have to say something about designing for testing and assessment specifically that I enjoy is that it's for two very different groups of people, the people who create exams and then the people who are actually taking the exams. So having to really understand the users on either side of the testing and assessment process is always a challenge that keeps me on my toes, but I really like how full circle it is.
Well, thank you, Emily. And yeah, both of you have such unique backgrounds for our space. Absolutely enthusiastic about jumping in here. So with those backgrounds in technology and user experience that you have, tell me a little bit more about your approach. How do you approach new design projects, especially with that user-centered nature in mind? And again, Gemma, we'll go to you first.
Of course. So for me, when approaching a new user-centered design project, I think it's essential to focus on understanding the needs, behaviors, and challenges of the users who will be interacting with it. So instead of designing from the perspective of business needs or their financial goals, user-centered design instead places focus on designing from the perspective of the user. And in order to design from that perspective, a major part of starting a new project is to understand your potential users. And this is done through user research. This research can come in several different forms, but two common methods are through interviews and surveys. And the goal of these is to understand, again, the needs, the behaviors, and possible pain points of your users. So if we take like a really simple example, like if you can imagine like a grocery delivery app on your phone, you know, after talking to potential users, you know, the base need of this app and the user using it is a quick and easy way to place orders and have them delivered to your home, right? That's baseline user need. And after talking to several, you know, potential users, you start to see like common threads in their behaviors. So maybe, you know, they typically place one order a week, or they have repeat items that they like to order with every single order that they place. And then when you're identifying pain points, you'll probably also see common threads like, you know, maybe the search functionality within the app is slow or doesn't give you, you know, relevant results, or, you know, going back to the idea of repeated items, adding those to an order might be cumbersome, and having to manually add them every single week to your order. So like for me, when starting a new user-centered design project, I place high importance on conducting that user research so I can really clearly understand their needs and challenges, and you're just not making assumptions as a designer. And in turn, I think that user research becomes very valuable in helping the team prioritize what areas of the project that they really need to focus in on.
Emily, what about you? What maybe different approaches or additive things did you want to mention in that vein?
I think Gemma hit the nail on the head when describing user-centered design. Something I'll talk about a little bit, though, is approaching user-centered design coming from a technology background. I found that it really gives you the ability to design from the user's perspective while also understanding the development limitations that might be at play. So the reality of design is that sometimes the most perfect design is simply not possible from a development perspective. So it's been such an interesting experience at Straz figuring out how to design experiences that truly are user-centered, but that are also realistic for development to implement.
Well, I think you've hit a key factor there. There's always impediments. There's always elements of that that have to be taken into account. I certainly have found that through my years in testing. You can come up with a grand vision, but both operational and technology restrictions come to play. So certainly good to get those factored in. I mean, as you explore these projects further, tell me a little bit more about, you know, what you're trying to understand within the users themselves, their preferences, their makeups, demographics, what have you. You know, really, how do you approach that, Emily?
So I think with any field, it's important to always be thinking about what is going to make the user's life easier and to consider all types of users that will be interacting with your products. And this is just to make sure that it's inclusive and accessible. It's essential to put yourself in the shoes of your user and try to understand what their thinking will be when they're using your product. So for our field of testing and assessment, I always try to keep in mind what our clients need readily available when they're going through the process of creating an exam. So what elements do they need accessible at all times? Which elements can take more of a back seat on the interface? Which can we create quick views of to have on the user's dash if they need it right away every day? So when I'm talking about these things, I'm thinking a lot about Straz has an item banking application called Pro that is, it's a massive application. There are so many functions and features that we offer. So it's really important to consider what our users need easy access to make their exam building process as seamless as possible. That being said, though, we do also design for test takers. So when I'm working on a product that will be used by an actual test taker, my mindset shifts a little bit. The first thing I'll think about is like the high anxiety levels of someone taking a certification exam. So this is something that they've studied hard for and they've taken time out of their lives to prepare for. And a lot of times it's an exam that could strongly impact the trajectory of their career. So there's a lot of stake here. And so in this type of scenario, I'm designing for simplicity. That is my main objective. You have to keep in mind here that this particular user is probably really stressed and probably really nervous, and they may not be viewing your designed interface with as clear of a head as some other users. So my job becomes to make that interface as clear, intuitive, accessible, and inclusive as possible. And this is actually a good time to bring up ADA compliance. This is key in this type of situation because you want all users, all types of users, to only have to stress out about their performance on the exam and not whether or not this exam interface was designed specifically for their needs. So I think to sum all of that up, when I'm designing, my main objective is to empathize with the user, no matter what the product is.
And Emily, I think you bring a good point up there because, you know, when we talk about accessibility and accommodations, to your point about simplicity, it's not just designing for individuals in those distinct categories, but I imagine you also have to be thinking about individuals who, may not be coming from the same background with regard to technological aptitude. You know, we talk a lot about the digital divide within assessment. So I imagine it's both compounded, thinking about the accommodations aspect and some very distinct, use cases there, but also the individual who may not be interfacing with the computer platforms that we're kind of accustomed to on a weekly basis. Gemma, what do you have to add there? Given the diversity of your background with Stras, where would you go with that question?
Yeah, I agree with, everything that Emily just described. I think it's just, at the core of it, we really need to just keep, our users in the forefront of our mind as we consider, users' needs, emotions, challenges, what kind of stress they're under, what they're trying to get done, what their motivations are. So I think as designers, we always need to try and keep the focus there and drive our solutions from the user's experience.
Makes complete sense, Gemma. And just kind of taking that next step, what are you finding as the key challenges, particularly as you seek to explore, comprehend, and then apply those user preferences? Where are those key challenges coming from today? And especially with, the fact that so many in today's world, their expectations are set sky high. I will not bring up specific, brands here, but I think about the common platforms that probably a lot of the population engage with every day that certainly set expectations in the stratosphere to a certain extent. So how does that also factor into the challenges that you run up against on a weekly basis? And Gemma, I'll let you take this one first.
Sure. So user-centered design faces key challenges in today's world for sure, particularly, as you said, some tech giants like Apple, Google, and Amazon. These companies have really redefined what users expect from digital products. And while this might create difficulties for smaller businesses and their ability to match those expectations set by, users of these large organizations, I think it also provides some insight into how we can improve our products and services and how we might prioritize those improvements within our own projects. But to point out some key challenges specifically, one of them is users today, just in general, have high expectations. They expect that, a product, service, or, workflow is seamless, it's intuitive, it's polished, it looks professional. And above that, there's the idea of instant gratification, right? It needs to be fast loading and responsive. No one's going to stick around if your product is slow and clunky and maybe just looks unprofessional and untrustworthy. Another challenge that we're facing today is just dealing with technology. Technology is always evolving, and users will be expecting to see cutting edge features that might incorporate things like AI or AR, which is augmented reality. So for designers, we have to keep a finger on the pulse of these advances and adapt to new tech, and while making sure that we continue to ensure that our design solutions are user friendly and intuitive. But a big challenge today, I feel like, is this sort of tug of war between user needs and business needs. That requires careful balance and consideration. User-centered design is based around the idea that of what the user needs, but businesses at the end of the day also need to be profitable. So to illustrate this, let me give you like a personal example of mine. So there's this live streaming platform called Twitch. I'm not sure if you've heard of it before. You have? Okay. It's basically a website, for those who don't know, originated in the gaming community, where gamers could stream a video game that they're playing and users can watch, chat, and interact with that person and other users in real time. And Twitch is great because it is, at its core, a free service. I personally watch and visit my favorite Twitch streamers every day for multiple hours a day, even if I'm just using it as background noise. But yeah, when Twitch first launched, there were no ads. The user just had to, you know, just log on, find the person that they're looking to watch and be right in. And this was a great experience. But as the platform grew, especially over the COVID era, where people were stuck at home and looking for, you know, new ways to like interact with communities that they, you know, belong to, Twitch blew up, and it's estimated about 150 million users visit Twitch a month. So at that point, Twitch was like, okay, we need to start bringing in some money, generate some revenue. And they did this through ads. And while like pre-stream ads, so ads you would see before you get to your content, that's fine. You can just sit through it. And then once you watched it, you're done and you can enjoy your content. But there's also ads now that appear in stream. So during, you know, for example, if a video gamer is in like a really high intense part of their match, you know, all of a sudden a user is jump scared by a 2-3-5 minute ad for, you know, an energy drink or something like that. And then it really like takes you out of the moment. And, you know, there are so many times where I was invested in what was happening only to miss key moments at the end because of these ads. So like, you know, another real world example of this is like you're at the movies and it's like getting to the climax of the plot and all of a sudden paper towels, you know, sort of like the experience in a very jarring way. So in order to address this issue, while growing their revenue, Twitch introduced a paid subscription model that eliminates all ads for users who pay $12 a month for that for the ad-free experience. And I personally happily pay this as I use Twitch every single day. And you know, the ability to watch hours of content without an ad is worth that cost for me. So while Twitch is still a free service and most users are free users, Twitch does offer an enhanced experience for those who are interested in investing, you know, that couple dollars a month to have that privilege. So, you know, to bring it all back, you know, this is an example of that tug of war between like, you know, a user-centered experience and, you know, potential business needs. And as a Twitch user, will I still be willing to pay it when it goes from $12 to $20? You know, ask me again in 3 to 5 years and I'll be able to tell you.
I think you're being optimistic on the 3 to 5 years piece, Gemma. But at the same time, I think that's such a great example of not only dealing with incredible challenges with the diversity backgrounds of the, you know, a user base, a customer base, but also those conflicting or at times oppositional forces that you all have to contend with. And I must say, yes, I have personally never been on Twitch, but three stepkids, so I'm familiar. as just saying that makes me feel incredibly old. So with that, I'm going to pivot. Emily, what additional challenges have you found?
I want to talk a little bit more about what Gemma said about users having really high expectations these days. Like she mentioned, big tech companies have set really high standards that users have now accepted as the norm. But I personally think that these standards are a good thing, and they push smaller companies to hold themselves accountable and create more seamless, accessible, and inclusive experiences. And I think one of the more current design trends that I want to talk about that is enabling companies to achieve this standard is the introduction of a design system for your products. So for those of you who don't know, a design system is essentially a set of standards and reusable components that help designers and developers establish consistency and uniformity across their applications. So what's great about a design system is that when you create these components and you make this initial design system, you can ensure that all of these components are ADA compliant, screen reader friendly, and all of those good things that you want in your application, so that when you use them time and time again across applications, you know you're creating a more accessible and inclusive experience for all types of users. I think that one of the biggest challenges is making sure you are designing and developing an inclusive experience and making sure it's ADA compliant, screen reader friendly, and all the things I mentioned. And I think design systems really help with that.
Well, I think you are happening onto a good subject to visit as well there, Emily, and that is, we're talking about challenges. I guess, of course, a lot of times those challenges lead to trends. And so, yeah, what are the trends in addition to design systems that you're contending with?
So right now in design, I think the biggest trends we're seeing are dark mode, minimalism, 3D visuals, more playful illustrations, and micro interactions. The latest products that I've personally worked on have really leaned into minimalism and modernism while providing the user with more playful visuals and graphics to bring a little bit of light and joy to their everyday tasks. For example, in our standard setting application at Straz SetScore, we have customized all of our error pages. So they all have a lighthearted illustration along with the error message itself. So even though everyone hates to run into an error while they're working, putting this lighthearted illustration is more likely to brighten their mood and is definitely less scary than a blank error page. But I think that the latest trends that I mentioned, they're aimed at keeping the user engaged while providing them with a clear and simple interface. So it's exactly what users have come to expect in their day-to-day lives, and it's important that we as designers keep up with those expectations.
Oh, thanks, Emily. And sorry, I didn't get to my mute button in time. The classic line of 2021 continues to be the one in 2024. I appreciate those highlights and also for some of the explanation there, because I know for many in our audience, they might be unfamiliar with some of those terms. So again, Gemma, for you, what's an extension of some of those trends that Emily's mentioned or others that you're running into?
I think she's hit most of the ones that I'm seeing as trending these days. But I really, really do love the idea of incorporating a little playfulness into designs. Like I, for one, you know, being a designer, always appreciate, you know, a touch of graphics or visuals element to support pages. And I think it gives, you know, designs, as Emily said, a bit of life and fun. But to tie it up, you know, design trends and conventions are always evolving. So it's our job as designers just to stay aware of the ever-changing landscape of design and user experience as a whole.
Also curious, just with those factors for both of you, how do you see the you know, for example, the lighthearted nature of a platform or the minimalism of a platform, how do you see that as creating additional engagement? You know, to what extent do you see that as a key factor toward keeping somebody you know, within the experience engaged and well, you know, I hate to say it this way, right? Not dozing off and or going to busy work as they're really trying to engage in a system that is functionally targeted toward productivity, for example. Emily, do you want to try to hit that first?
Sure. Yeah, I think that specifically micro interactions and the playful visuals we were just talking about, for testing and assessment users specifically, a lot of the tasks they're doing, it's the same day to day. Like it could be kind of tedious. I'm thinking specifically of standard setting. Like it's a very long and tedious process. But I think using these playful visuals and micro interactions and feeling like you're engaging with the interface or feel like the interface is engaging with you, I think it keeps you more locked into what you're doing. Whereas if you were just filling out a form on a blank screen, you might lose interest pretty quickly and then your mind could go elsewhere.
So Emily, particularly for my psychometric or more scientific side users, tell me about micro interactions, or Gemma, perhaps. What are they? How is that defined?
So micro interactions is little bits of feedback when you're interacting with like a button per se, that sort of gives you just a touch of feedback as the user, just as they interact with different elements on the form. It just gives it a little bit of more of like a life to what you're working with. And it's not just, just a simple hover state. Maybe it has a slight animation when you click on something or hover over something. It just gives a little bit more interactiveness. That's not such a big in your face interruptive sort of interaction, but something just subtle to sort of enhance your design and the tasks that the user is trying to complete.
Thank you, Gemma. I appreciate it, because I think a few folks in the audience would be scratching their heads at that one. So I think it's great to point that out, because I can immediately think of multiple systems that use that feedback mechanism, that engagement mechanism, to keep me on the page engaged, knowing that the platform's responding to what I'm trying to do. Well, just to bring everything all together, with the diversity of your backgrounds and coming into the testing and assessment space, as you said well, Gemma, by accident, which, by the way, is, I think, applies to a lot of people in that space, myself included. Just what have been your biggest learnings as you've engaged with both our clients as well as customers and users in this space? What are those things that stick out to you? And Gemma, for you, more than a decade of experience in the space.
Yes. So as I mentioned in the beginning, I'm currently not in the testing assessment space, but I can definitely share what I've learned from my experience working on designs for that auditing web app that I described earlier. Since it's a project that's an application for auditors and the work that they do, it's a challenge for me because I am not an auditor and I'm not a CPA. So when I meet with product owners to discuss designs for new functionality or new screens, I have to bite the bullet sometimes and ask those, quote unquote, silly or stupid questions in order to understand, the user's needs properly, even if on a high level. And sometimes I have to tap into my ability to sort of mentally block out some of the conversational tangents that might occur between POs and those meetings that don't really fully apply to the design work and the user needs that we're trying to fulfill. But one thing that I always do is ask for recordings of those meetings with POs, so I can always go back and refer to the recording while I create in solutions and mock-ups. And I always, always end up referring to those.
I'm not surprised whatsoever, especially with working with a group that is that distinct. So, Emily, what about you?
I completely agree with what Gemma said. I think in any field, it's important to take a step back and look at the bigger picture, especially when you're not someone who's an expert in the field you're designing for. So I think one of the biggest things I've learned, and again, this applies to any field, is to know when to really push back and advocate for the user, even when business really wants to push you in a different direction. As a designer, you are the voice of the user and you are the one advocating for them. They're not in the room, so no one's speaking up for them except for you. So it's important to find that fine line between meeting business needs and completely satisfying the user and knowing when compromise is necessary or appropriate. But specifically for testing and development, another big thing I've learned is how to become an expert on something that at the start of the process, you maybe know nothing about. So as I mentioned previously, Strauss was my first introduction to the testing and assessment world. So I'm still learning everything there is to know about this field. But when we're creating a new product, I have to know everything about the process we're designing for to create the most enjoyable user experience. So user research, starting conversations with real life users, user testing and checking in for feedback with users once the product has launched, they're all crucial to ensure you're truly creating a product that's for the user.
Well, I love that, Emily. And I have to tell you, you know, as somebody with over 20 years in the field, you will keep learning because after 20 years, I'm still learning things. And in fact, I'm learning a couple things from this conversation that I'll certainly bear in mind as we go forward. Well, I want to thank you both for taking time away from what I know are your very busy schedules to spend some time chatting with me. As I said, I've learned a few things. I hope those who listen to the episode take some things away as well. So really appreciate your time. And for those who have made it through the episode, I look forward to welcoming you back in a couple weeks on our next episode of our Straz podcast. Thank you very much for taking the time and look forward to seeing you soon.
Thank you so much.